Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest on the show today is Chase Madar. He's a lawyer in New York, and he's the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. I don't know if they're updating the cover of that thing or what, but it don't matter. It's a great book. You really ought to read it. Hey, sometimes people change their identities. You know, I don't care. And that it really is a great book, too. I read the whole thing, and I highly recommend it to people if you want to understand the story of Bradley Manning and the origin of the WikiLeaks there. And, I hope especially it would inspire you to go digging through those State Department cables and those Iraq and Afghan war logs, et cetera. There's some great stories in those documents that are still to be told, even though, of course, thousands and thousands of great articles have been based on them so far. So Chase, you got this great new piece at TomDispatch.com. It's all also running at antiwar.com. And it's The Folly of Arming Israel it's under Tom Engelhardt's name at antiwar.com. But it's about U.S. aid to Israel. And I guess sort of first and foremost here, can we just start off with the amounts? Or in fact, even before the amounts, we just talk about how nobody talks about this. I think it kind of comes through that this is part of why you wrote this is because you don't see anybody else writing it.
Yeah, virtually no one is addressing this. And it's a really important issue. I mean, we're constantly getting news coverage of this peace process in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine. And it's just assumed that the United States and Washington is some kind of a neutral player, honestly and earnestly trying to reconcile these two parties. But this clashes tremendously with the virtually unreported fact that the U.S. is giving $3.1 billion in military aid to Israel year after year. They're the top recipient of U.S. foreign aid over the past 30 years. And this is doubly weird because they are a wealthy country with a GDP per head that's pretty much on par with the European Union average. So how can we pretend that we are a neutral referee, a neutral arbiter in this conflict if we are putting a fist on the scales for one of the parties to the tune of $3.1 billion in advanced weaponry? And that weaponry is essential for Israel's domination and control of Palestine and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. It's incredibly significant. So that's why I wrote this piece. This whole question of giving military aid to Israel, lavish amounts of it, really needs to be debated searchingly because I don't think it's a good thing at all.
All right, now here's the thing about it too. As you say, and as you write about in your piece, it just sort of goes without saying. It's not that it's a secret or anything like that. It just gets no coverage at all. It's treated, it's like Chomsky says about all the best propaganda. It's the unspoken premise. It's just the assumption, the false, or not necessarily, unanimous, assumption behind all the arguments. And so there's just, if no one ever questions whether it's right to keep doing this, then it remains unquestionable and in the minds of people. And I don't say it very well, but it's a very powerful thing to have something just sort of off the shelf for discussion or off the table of discussion. That's only, outside of the goalposts of what's acceptable,
Yeah. I mean, U.S. aid to Israel and to a lesser degree, U.S. aid to Egypt, that's the second biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid over the past 30 years. It's taken in foreign policy elites to be just part of the natural order of the universe. You don't question it any more than you question, say, the Mississippi River or, because it's just a fact of nature, like the force of gravity or something. And now, when occasionally people do question it, there's a whole arsenal of incredibly creaky, tired, disingenuous arguments to defend it. I mean, one of them is that, oh, well, we have to give Israel $3.1 billion in advanced weaponry every year because they're our ally. Now, of course, we have dozens of allies all over the world, but we don't arm them to the teeth like we do Israel. Or another one, and this one's my favorite, is that if we don't heavily arm Israel, then we will be retreating back into isolationism.
Wait a minute. Go back. Let's get back to isolationism, because that's a good one. I like it. But on the they are our ally, there's that unsaid assumption, right, is that if we weren't giving them all these weapons, they'd be extinct. They would all be killed. This is necessary.
Yeah.
Since we are our ally, we are bound to give them as much as is necessary for them to survive, even though nobody ever proves that bogus assumption underlying the argument.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just assumed that they depend for their survival of their people on massive infusions of U.S. aid. And, that's pretty potent emotional blackmail, especially after a century of truly genocidal anti-Semitism. I mean, you can see why that sticks and why playing that card works. It's not a rational argument, though, and they do not depend on American aid for their survival or their security. By now, Israel has an incredibly powerful and thoroughly modern military, the biggest and most potent military in the region, the most advanced, including nuclear weapons, which they've had since the late 60s.
Yep. So, well, that's why you've got to leave that assumption unsaid. Because once you say it out loud, you go, well, no, that's not true. They're as powerful as, France or something militarily. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea that they depend on military aid for security and survival is totally bogus. And I think it really has a negative effect in encouraging really bad behavior on the part of successive Israeli governments across the political spectrum to keep up their violent colonization and ethnic cleansing of historic Palestine. After all, if you're going to get year after year this free, gratis supply of weapons, no matter what you do, you have no incentive to change your behavior in any way. And that's what we've seen.
Right. Well, and when you talk about the $3.5 billion a year, they even passed an appropriation, which I guess, the money is to be doled out on a yearly basis or maybe a biannual basis or something. But the bill itself guaranteed $30 billion over the next 10 years plus.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that is banned by the U.S. Constitution when you're talking about the Congress appropriating money to the military. Any military appropriation can only be for 2 years at a time, max. There's just too much incentive to build them up into a permanent, collection of job holders. But when it comes to Israel, no, we'll pass a law promising them welfare just into the indefinite future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and another bogus argument that's related to this is that Israel is this wonderful strategic asset to the United States, that, in fact, we depend on giving all this aid to Israel because it benefits our security, and that it, having Israel there, loyally cashing checks and receiving our shipments of military material is somehow good for us. This doesn't stand to reason either. Even if you accept Washington's foreign policy on its own terms, which, you and I don't, but a lot of people do, let's think about how was this client-state relationship with Israel actually useful in either Gulf War? Can that be explained in two sentences? No, it can't be. It's also very, well-established, and you hear this from unguarded moments from U.S. military officers as well as terrorists that our funding relationship, our lavish donations of military aid to Israel, really inspire a lot of ill will towards the United States and direct a lot of wrath and, in the end, terrorism against American targets. It promotes anti-Americanism in the region. And that does not make us safer, needless to say.
Right. Well, and, you know, this is why I got such a chip on my shoulder about it, is because of, you know, just very straight journalism. For example, like by Terry McDermott, L.A. Times reporter, and Lawrence Wright, reporter for The New York Times. When these guys write, or James Bamford, for that matter, when these former producer for, you know, World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, this kind of caliber of journalism, these guys write that, hey, it's just a scientific fact, man. There's no disputing it, and they don't have a bone to pick about it. They're just reporting the fact to you that Bin Laden himself and Mohammed Atta said that the reason that they did what they did on 9/11 was due in great part to America's support for the Israelis, and not for their existence, and not for being a bunch of nice guys, but for their permanent, at that point at least, occupation of southern Lebanon, and their occupation of Palestine, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And the hell that they unleash on their Palestinian helots on a constant basis. That was part of it. In fact, Israel's war in Lebanon, where they did the Qana massacre, at that same time was when Mohammed Atta, I think it was the day before or something, they say, Mohammed Atta filled out his last will and testament. And then Bin Laden, when he put out his first declaration of war, the Qana massacre in Lebanon and a lot of the rest of Palestine issues take up about a third of that thing. This is why they're attacking the United States, because of what we're doing in Palestine. So I'm not saying that's necessarily why we should not back Israel, but boy, we ought to have to take into account that that's the price we're paying for backing Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to take a hard look at the strategic costs and benefits when it comes to lavishly arming and bankrolling Israel. And the question of the liabilities, which you just listed, you know, perfectly, are, I mean, that's something that seldom comes up, and most Americans are oblivious to it, even though it has been reported, you know, from pretty unimpeachable sources, too. It's not every foreign policy issue where concern for human rights and kind of basic morality are in pretty perfect alignment with questions of strategy and national self-interest and security. But this is one of them. I mean, we get nothing out of lavishly bankrolling Israel. But the human rights cost is huge, I mean, with the ongoing ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, and the blockade of Gaza and the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem on the one hand, plus the strategic liability to the U.S. There's really no good reason for it.
All right, y'all. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Chase Madar. He's the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, and he's got this great piece at TomDispatch.com and Antiwar.com about USA to Israel, the folly of arming Israel. We'll be right back after this. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, and this great piece at TomDispatch.com and at Antiwar.com. It's called The Folly of Arming Israel. And let's see, we're talking about, the general strategic liability of Israel. We hear all this hype really loud about, oh, it's the only democracy in the Middle East. Never mind, America always cancels anybody else's elections because they never turn out the way the Israelis wanted. But, oh, so that makes them our bestest friends. But again, with the unspoken assumptions and premises of these questions, nobody ever really explains what a great benefit America gets for being friends with the Israelis. And I try real hard to be honest and self-critical and whatever as best I can, and I really try, and I don't know what benefit. Can anybody tell me what America gets out of this relationship as far as even the empire's interest, Washington, D.C.'s interest, never mind, you know, the greater wealth and freedom and prosperity of the American people? You know, I just don't know. Do you, Chase?
I don't see it either, Scott. No way. In my article, one thing I try to do is just to correct the language about how we talk about the U.S. relationship with Israel, because there's so much euphemism and so much disingenuous half-truth and some outright lies here. For one thing, we need to stop talking about Israel as an ally and call it for what it is, a client state. We also need to stop talking about a peace process when we're arming one side in the conflict to the teeth. What we have is a war process. And instead of talking about settlement expansion, we need to use words like violent colonization and ethnic cleansing, because that's what it is. And I have a feeling that if this kind of thing were happening in the Balkans or elsewhere, we would have no trouble using those words.
Well, and you know, the way you put it in your article, you win. I can't imagine what anybody could say to the argument of what if you just turned it around and it was the Arabs are coming and pushing the Jews out of their houses and bulldozing them, on 5 minutes notice and building a museum of their hurt feelings on top of your cemetery and all this kind of crap, the way the Israelis are doing, taking Jerusalem, the old city of Eastern Jerusalem and all that. In the West Bank. If it was the other way around, people would be completely freaking out. Can you imagine?
I mean, there would be calls for airstrikes in Washington. I mean, people would be freaking out. And, you know, justifiably so.
Yeah, exactly. It would be horrible,
there,
right?
You know, what's going on right now on a day-to-day basis and what's getting done to Palestinians is horrible. It's an absolute violation of their most basic human rights. For whatever it's worth, it's a violation of international law, and it's certainly a violation of just any basic standard of morality or common decency. And, what we Americans really need to know and absorb and internalize is that we are not just sitting on the sidelines as a friendly referee trying to make peace. We are actively involved in this nightmare. And we are actively arming a country that is committing ethnic cleansing. There's no way around that. No matter what kind of rich palette of euphemism you use, that's the bottom line. We are lavishly arming and bankrolling and providing diplomatic cover to a country that is perpetrating ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the first step is just to recognize our own responsibility in this and change our own role. You know, there's a lot of lively intellectual debate in the U.S. about the BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And, you know, people of goodwill disagree on it. Me, I think it's a good thing. I'm all for it. But I know smart people who don't agree with me there. There's also a lot of debate about, is a one-state solution for Israel and Palestine the best, where they'd have equal rights, or a two-state solution, where you have one country for the Israelis and one for the Palestinians? But the one thing that does not get discussed, and I find this incredibly weird, is our own active role, because that is what we are most responsible for in the end. What we are doing, not what we're not doing. And that's why I wrote this piece. We just have to look at this front and center, our vigorous role in giving $3.1 billion to Israel year after year in advanced military equipment, not to mention military training exercises, a lot of military research for the Iron Dome Missile Defense Project, and constant diplomatic cover in the UN and elsewhere. Right. We're a major player in this game, and yet we pretend that we aren't. And in the piece, I compared most U.S. news coverage of Israel-Palestine to this one Agatha Christie novel. I'm going to spoil an Agatha Christie novel for everyone. People may want to, you know, turn off the set for a little bit. But there's this great Agatha Christie novel called The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and it's narrated in the first person from this very calm, semi-detached voice of a guy who's, you know, observing the action, commenting on it, telling the story. And guess who turns out to be the killer, the narrator? And that's a good, I think, metaphor for so much U.S. news coverage of the Middle East in general, but especially the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Mm. All right. Well, so there's this article today. It's in the Times of Israel, which is a pretty right-wing paper. I don't know everything about who runs it or whatever, but it seems pretty right-wing paper to me. And they say, on a single source, unverified, they even admit, but it sounds right, Kerry fails to get Obama backing to confront Israel on peace terms. And what it says is that Kerry really wanted to go in there and tell the Israelis, look, man, come on, make a deal within this framework, whatever his stupid framework is and whatever, and that, but he just doesn't have the backing of the White House to, you know, make any threat or any promise really stick. And the reason I buy it is because this is what Andrew Coburn reported, was that Obama will be damned if John Kerry's going to solve this Israel-Palestine thing and take all the credit instead of him. And he'd rather they all burn forever than let John Kerry be the big man of the day or whatever. So that's fine. I could see how that works, you know, all like that among Democrats. But so then my question is this. I actually have a question after all this, is that after this falls apart and doesn't work, and the peace process is a joke for the umpteenth millionth time, whatever it is, does it matter that in the EU or, I don't know, Eastern allies or any other powers on earth, does it matter that, come on, it's too difficult to pretend that we believe that the Americans mean well and are some kind of honest broker here? I mean, I know there's the BDS movement, but as far as the nation states of, you know, that have any power and influence here, does it matter if the Americans basically, it's not the right term for it, but bluff their way out of legitimacy as the dealer at the game? You know what I mean?
You know, I think that the sooner the U.S. stops pretending to be a neutral arbiter and an honest broker here, the better. It's just past the point of any possibility for Washington to realistically broker something. And, you know, I've got to read is it a Patrick Coburn article?
No, it's Andrew Coburn.
I mean, they're both really smart guys, and I love their work. I think it's just structurally impossible, even if Obama or Kerry, you know, work together and put their all into resolving this, you can't put your foot on the gas and on the brake at the same time and expect to make any kind of progress. And that's what we're doing. On the one hand, lavishly funding and bankrolling Israel, no matter what they do. And then on the other hand, you know, spinning wheels and saying you're working for peace. They don't go together. I mean, you can't, you're not part of a peace process if you're lavishly arming one side. And think about it. I mean, if you were Israel, why on earth would you make any compromises and accept any limits on your power if you know that you're still going to get that sweet shipment of $3.1 billion worth of advanced weaponry year after year, no matter what you do? The level of American military funding and assistance to Israel is only going up, and Obama bragged, you know, and he was completely accurate, that no president has overseen as much military aid to Israel as he has. So they have no incentive in Israel to make any compromises, to make any peace, and they'll be happy to, you know, let this go away. Now, in the past, when a peace deal collapses and fails, it's been the habit in the U.S. to blame it all on the weakest party in this trio, the Palestinian. That's going to be a little harder to do this time. I mean, there's just nothing left to squeeze out of them at this point. And, you know, more and more people are reporting on how Netanyahu and his cabinet members are just openly contemptuous of John Kerry and even of Obama. And they're not a very, you know, cuddly, fuzzy group of people the way, say, the old Labor Party people were to many American intellectuals. There's going to be, you know, a real test of America's journalistic creativity to find a way to blame this on the Palestinians. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Or, well, they'll just oversimplify it and make it the unproven, unspoken assumption that, you know, how them savage Arabs are, and no offer's ever good enough for them. They don't ever have to prove it. They just say it, and everybody digs it. They just, it sounds right to people, I guess. I don't know. I'm sorry, I want to keep talking to you, but I got to go. We're all out of time. Thanks very much for your time on the show again, Chase.
Great talking with you again, Scott. Take care now.
All right, y'all. That is the great Chase Madar. He's a lawyer in New York, but he's still great. He's the great Chase Madar. Writes for Tom Dispatch. He's also the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. Great book about Bradley Manning and the WikiLeaks there. The State Department cables and all that. You should know. Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours so they're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonks.org/liberty. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. But the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.